Then Emmanuel Suttles, that was an outstanding hitter. Outfielder named Wright. I can't remember his first name. He's great, and they were good. But no one really thought that, you know, they thought they were, you know, entertainers, which is wrong, but sad.
Tell us about your confrontation with Satchel Paige as a teenager. Was he as famous then as he is now, or?
Well, Satchel Paige, especially in California, because he pitched out there every winter, and he was awesome. He really, his reputation preceded him because he was regarded as the greatest pitcher to ever live, black or white, by a lot of people. And so when I played, it was at Wrigley Field, where the LA Angels played their games in the Pacific Coast League, and later on the and when they expanded, the California Angels played in that ballpark. It was a pretty good-sized Major League ballpark. They would seat about 25,000 people there. And so I hit against him, and I'm a kid, and I'm 17, and I don't know, you know, I'm scared to death. And this guy is going to be, you won't see the ball. I mean, in my mind, it was there. And well, earlier in the interview, I said I had my first home run in the major leagues, the right field. I hit my first home run really against Satchel Paige, the right field.
Wow.
And now that it's interesting story is that, what's the name? We just talked about him, O'Neill.
Buck O'Neill?
Buck O'Neill. Buck O'Neill was on that ball club with Satchel Paige that day. And then later on, he's with the Cubs as a coach, and he told me the story. When I hit that home run, Satchel Paige to right field, Paige, when he came in, said, who hit the home run? Paige didn't know anybody. He said, who hit the home run off me? And and Buck O'Neill said, well, it was a kid that's playing baseball in high school, and he hit a home run off you. He says, what's his number? He says, he's wearing number 4. He says, tell me when number 4 comes up again. So I came up again, and he struck me out. I mean, it was kind of I wasn't going to do it twice. And I wouldn't have done it twice either. But, of course, later on I saw him when he pitched in the major leagues at a very old age. But the one thing about him that I remember, he had immaculate control, and he could throw a ball anywhere he wanted to, and he was extremely fast. I don't think he was as fast as Bob Feller, but he was passing up, I mean, and he had great control, and he threw kind of sidearm, kind of almost like Walter Johnson, kind of a slingshot type throwing. And he had a very hard curveball, very short and very fast. And the way he warmed up for ball games, he would take infield at third base and then go out and pitch. No one ever did that. Mm.
Mm. Who were some of the pitchers that were prominent when you broke in?
Well, the people ask me who was the toughest pitcher I ever hit against. And there's no argument of whatsoever. Yul Blackwell. And most of the people say, Yul who? And I said, Yul Blackwell. And they said, never heard of him. Well, in 1947, he won 16 games in a row. Won over 20 games. He almost pitched back-to-back no-hitters. He pitched a no-hitter against the Boston Braves and came down to Brooklyn. And Eddie Stanky got a base hit through his legs in the ninth inning with one man out, or what they duplicated Vandermeer's feat of back-to-back no-hitters. Yul Blackwell threw about 98 miles an hour, sidearm, out of here, and was mean on top of it. And he wouldn't hesitate to knock you down. Mm-hmm. And the thing about him was you couldn't find the ball because it would come out of third base, and before you could find the ball or pick it up, it was almost on top of you, which made him seem like he's throwing 200 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And he was, to my wife, he was the toughest I ever hit against. I think the greatest pitcher I ever saw was Bob Feller. And Feller had a 100-mile-an-hour fastball with a curveball that never stopped. Mm-hmm. the closest to him, I guess, was Nolan Ryan of the modern day players.
Right.
But the players, all the pitchers, you know, all the good pitchers. Warren Spahn was a great pitcher, and if you wanted, if a modern day person, if they saw Sandy Koufax, Warren Spahn pitched the same way Sandy Koufax did. Hmm. And Warren Spahn, of course, won more games than any left-hand pitcher in the history of baseball. Mm-hmm. And he won 20 games for 13 straight, maybe not straight years, but 13 years. Mm-hmm. And didn't win a game until he was 26. But you see, you see him now, and you say, that man couldn't pitch at all. You know, he doesn't look like he ever could pitch. But he was tough. But the pitchers are, you know, the pitchers like the Ollie Reynolds and the Bob Lemons and the great pitchers, they were all tough. And they were all really challenges. I don't know of any, the easiest pitcher to hit against, and not the best pitcher, I mean, not the worst pitcher, but the easiest to hit against was Robin Roberts. But he was the hardest to hit against. He had a fastball that would just rise, and he could add on when he was in the jam, mm-hmm. and throw the ball faster when he had to get you out. And in those times, he was almost impossible to hit. But he's very easy to hit against, but you wouldn't get any hits. It was comfortable to hit against us. My point of like that.
Yeah.
He gave up 505 home runs.
Really? I
didn't realize. But you got to pitch well for a long time.
Yeah, right, to give up that many home runs. Right. That's right. In 1948, you seemed to have a lot of fun on Sundays. Do you remember that? Home runs on...
Yeah, I did. I don't remember that real well. I had a streak on Sunday. Well, you know why? We played doubleheaders. And I always wanted to play, too. Because you had more chances to see more pitches.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that now because of the length of the games. But
right.
But yeah, we played doubleheaders on Sundays all the time.
Oh, okay. That's right. That's right. People don't even know what doubleheaders are anymore.
So what was the streak?
It was 17 home runs in 38 Sunday games.
I didn't know that record. Yeah. Well, that's got to be the reason.
Right. Including 8 straight Sundays.
Is that right? I remember going over some Sunday in Boston, and I wanted to really commit suicide. I said I didn't hit a home run on Sunday, and I remember doing that. And I guess it had to be in connection with this because I said it's Sunday, I'm going to have to hit at least one home run.
Yeah, well, just about every other Sunday, yeah. You had a home run.
That's great. Your success in Pittsburgh almost had to feel like it was taking place in a vacuum because you were a very good player on some pretty bad teams, I guess, is trying to be polite, but last place teams. How was that difficult for you, or how did you feel about that, the success of the club?
It was extremely difficult to play with losing teams. In a way, I got some vicarious thrills of the Mets when they're good years as a broadcaster. There's nothing better than to go out and have a good day and win a ball game. And I can't say there's nothing worse than having a good day and losing a ball game because you offset it somewhat because you had a chance to help try and win. But losing day after day is the worst thing in the world. And of course, you miss a lot of acclaim that way because you might, like I've one game I hit two home runs in Ebbets Field I hit it off Carl Erskine and I drove in like 7 or 8 runs in the game. We got beat 12-11 or maybe it was 13-12 or whatever. And you lose that ball game. Well, if we had won the game and then you have you feel great.
Right.
But even though you have a chance to, and you've done well, it's not the same. And people that had never played, and I never got the chance to play in a World Series. I did, of course, All-Star games, which is always a great thrill and a great challenge. And you miss, on the All-Star games, there's electricity in there. Of course, I got that electricity and with the Mets as a broadcaster, and I broadcast World Series games, which is not quite the same, but it's still there. But playing on losing teams is not very good. It's no fun.
Remember an old anecdote that the team rule was not to have a collision? The infielders and center fielder were not to have a collision with you under any circumstance because you were the player on the team.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, our team, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, don't... Yeah, because, I was bringing all the people in the ballpark. And we didn't win many games. 1948, we had a pretty good run at it, and got beat out by the, as Casey Stengel called the team, the Quiz Kids. They brought up all those young guys in 1948, and they beat us in the very important series in Philly, and we had got knocked out of a chance to win then. Mm. We had a pretty good team that year.
That's as close as the Pirates, your Pirates teams came. Was 48, that
yeah.
was as close as you came?
That's right, yeah.
By June 3rd, 1953, it was over. You were traded to the Cubs with the now famous send-off, if we can finish last with you, we can finish last without you. How did you feel about the trade away, and what was life with the Cubs?
Well, that was when Ricky came over to be the GM of the Pittsburgh Pirates. I knew I was going to go. This philosophy was don't pay a lot of money out and make sure that you trade off his theory, which isn't a bad theory, really, when you think about it. Always trade a player. It's better to trade a player a year too soon than a year too late. And so I knew I was going to go. And he came over in 1953. And he came over at the end of the 52 season, I believe it was. No, I'm sorry. In 52. Okay. And in 52, we had the worst team you could have. We lost 112 games that year. Mm-hmm. And we had... high school players playing on our team. We had Bobby Del Greco. I just graduated from high school, center fielder, and first baseman that graduated from high school was playing first base. And it was really a bad team. And we finished last and lost 112 games. So I knew that sooner or later I was going to be out of there. So in 53, there was a lot of talk about trades, and it more or less boiled down to I was going to go to maybe Brooklyn, maybe Cincinnati, maybe the Cubs, and it was all hassle around in spring training also in the early part of the season. And I was really rooting for Chicago because I really didn't hit that well in Cincinnati. It was a real tough park to hit in for some reason. And Brooklyn I would have liked, but I didn't think that was going to be reality. And that would have been fine. And Chicago played all day ball at that time, and I thought I enjoyed day baseball better than the night ball. And so I knew it was going to be sooner or later I was going to get it. And in the winter of 52, I got my contract from Ricky, and he cut my salary 25%, which was the largest salary cut he could do.
Wow.
And of course, I argued back and forth through the mail and also television, Washington Union, and things like that. And didn't really get much done. It was still 25% cut. His son, the Twig, we called him, Branch's son, came out to... Palm Springs, was living there, and he came out with charts and everything about all these things I didn't do that year. Well, I didn't do them really because we didn't have a chance to do it. We had such a bad ball club. And so he set the stage, and so he told me how bad I had a year, and now the old man came out. And we met in Gilmore Field, which was the ballpark of the Hollywood Stars, club they worked with over the years. And we had a meeting there, and he came in, I met him there. We met in Bob Cobb's office. Now, Bob Cobb was the owner of the Brown Derbies out there, great restaurants, and he was married to a movie star, and he owned the ball club. And he's the man that named the Cobb salad. He invented the Cobb salad. He's in, and it was not related to Ty Cobb. But anyway, we met there. And of course, we argued back and forth. And finally, he said, "Son, would we finish?" And I said, "We finished last." He said, "We can finish last without you." Which meant I either took what he offered or I wouldn't play baseball. Mm-hmm. So I finally got a little compromise out of it. I said, "Well, we're going to train in Cuba this year." He had made a deal to train in Cuba with Batista, who was the head of the Cuban government at that time, mm-hmm. with the guy standing in the background in the mountains waiting to come in and take over, mm-hmm. Castro. Who incidentally had a tryout with the New York Giants as a pitcher and didn't make it. Just think, if he'd have made the team, we might have a different world.
Right.
And so we did the thing, and I said, "Well, I don't really want to go to Cuba. I'll get in shape in Southern California, and I'll get down there when you start playing the game." So, and that's, what is that, maybe 10 days later. Mm-hmm. He said, "That's all right with me." And so that was fine. I'd be down there and be there and play the games. And then the other thing was, I said, "Okay, you say that you can't afford to pay me because we finished so badly. If I get sold or traded to another ball club, I would like to have $5,000 to make up for some of the cut that you're giving me." And he said, "Okay, that's a deal." Well, as it turned out, the $5,000 wasn't going to come from him. It was going to come from the team that I got traded to. Mm-hmm. And Warren Giles was the president of the National League at the time. He saw the contract, and he said, "This is illegal. We have to take that out of the contract." So I never got the $5,000. And I also got traded to the Cubs. But that was a part of that whole deal.
Now, that year, you and Allie Reynolds hired someone to John Norman Lewis? To help
Jay Norman Lewis. Is his first name John? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what it said.
Okay, yeah, Jay Norman Lewis. We called him Norman. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and that was to give you advice on negotiating with loans. Whether the very
what
beginning?
It was not really what it was we wanted to have a representative, to a lawyer, to represent us and understand the legalities of the new contract that was being signed for the extension of the pension plan. Mm-hmm. It was originally signed up for 5 years and was due in 1952. And I was the National League player representative, and Allie Reynolds was the American League player representative. Mm-hmm. Reynolds hired him, and I said, "Oh, it's fine with me." And we had the winter meetings in Atlanta. And we went down there with our attorney, and we were called into the meeting, and here we come, three of us. And now the executive committee of the owners, they're there. One was O'Malley, I think Yaki was another one, and I think Galbraith was the other. And they had two attorneys. They said, "You can come in, but he can't." And so we walked out. They said, "If our attorney isn't allowed in and you have your attorneys, it seems unfair." And we walked out. And that started the sequence of setting up the new pension plan. And I was raised in Southern California and lived in Palm Springs and was around a lot of the movie crowd, the people, not necessarily the actors, although I knew a lot of them, but the producers and directors, and they were talking about pay TV in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which also was a reason why O'Malley, in my opinion, wanted to go from Brooklyn to L.A. to get pay TV. And so I knew about this potential thing that might be with television. And so they after we walked out, they formed a committee of Greenberg and John Galbraith, Allie Reynolds, and myself. And we used J. Norman Lewis, but he was not an integral part of the deal at all there. And so my theory was we would ask for 66 2/3% of the money is derived from the All-Star Game and the World Series, which is a similar amount of money they got for radio rights to the All-Star Game and the World Series. Mm-hmm. And Rayberg was the man involved that was really helpful in the whole deal for both sides. And we worked out a deal where it became 60%. So we lost 6 2/3%, but 60% seemed to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so the pension plan money that was going to the pension plan was 60% of those television rights, which later on was changed, but we got that through. And they took that back to the owners, and they got it through, Galbraith and Hank Greenberg. So again, Hank was very instrumental in helping us, me specifically. Mm-hmm. And Jerry Norman Lewis, he had another guy named Durante involved in that deal, assistant attorney, but he never got involved. Mm-hmm. But that was the start of what became a great pension plan. And at no time did we ever talk about free agency or anything else. It was never, ever a thought by any player or really? Ever brought up. Mm. That was 1952.
Mm-hmm. Hank was in management.
He was on the management. He was in 52. He was with Vec at Cleveland.
Oh, okay.
What did you? What were your off seasons like? They must be very different than what baseball players' off seasons are like now.
No, mine were pretty good. Mm-hmm. I was playing golf with Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and Palm Springs and
okay.
dating Elizabeth Taylor and all that. I thought, mine were all right.
Why don't you tell us about
that? Well, let's take a walk down that road.
Yeah, it sounds like some interesting times.
Yeah.
Well, I was single all this time. I didn't get married until I was 27. And so when the Pirates were bought by Bing Crosby and from the old family, Dreyfus family, not Dreyfus, Benzweiger family, Crosby, Galbraith, McKinney, and Johnson were the new owners. Mm-hmm. And of course, Crosby had a small part of the ownership, I believe might have been 5%. And I got then to meet him and see him, and of course, I played golf with him in Palm Springs before that. But I knew him better, and one day, a coach of the Pirates, a guy named John McKee, and I went out to watch Crosby make a movie picture, Paramount. And interestingly, making a movie takes a lot of time, and they have to use doubles and stand-ins and all this sort of thing. And Crosby in the studio, which is a big studio, had a big carpet on the wall, and he would hit golf balls under this carpet while they were getting the scenes set for the movie of Camelot was a movie at the time. So anyway, we talked with him, and he was a tremendous sports fan, and a great golfer. He was a scratch player and won club championships and everything else. And he said, "How would you like to have a date with Elizabeth Taylor?" I thought he was kidding me, and I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, I'll set it up for you." So he got his PR man, whatever it was. They were both with Paramount at that time, and he arranged for me to contact her, and I contacted her, and we were going to a movie called 12 O'Clock High, premiere of the movie in Hollywood. Mm. And it was an old-fashioned premiere where they had people sitting on the street of Hollywood Boulevard, mm-hmm. and bleachers, and they had keg lights going around the sky. And I went over to pick her up at her house. She was living with her mother and father. And I was driving a Cadillac with the top down. I thought I was going to really impress her. And she was late, and I sat there talking with her father for about half an hour. And finally, she was ready to go, and we get in and drive to the Grumman Sinise Theater, where they had this premiere. And as it turned out, we were the last ones to get in the theater. And the man that took my car said, "What's your name?" I said, "Ralph Gunner." He says, "Okay, I'm taking your car." And we went in, it was really a festive thing, interviewed by the top writers of Hollywood writers and things like that. Well, we saw the movie came out, and I'm sitting there, and I hear this guy in the PA system say, "Mr. Gary Cooper's car, please." And I guess the car would drive up and he'd save somebody else. So I finally went up to him. I said, "Would you page my car?" And he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Ralph Kiner." He said, "Okay." And he says, "Mr. Ralph Kiner's car, please." We stood there and waited and waited and waited. Now it's getting late. The crowds are thinning out. Now I'm getting a little bit hot. And I finally went to him and said, "Would you pay for my car again?" He says, "Well, your chauffeur must have fallen asleep." I looked at him and said, "Chauffeur? I don't have a chauffeur." He says, "Well, then your car is out there." and he pointed to a vacant lot about 100 yards away. And so here we go walking with Elizabeth Theodore in a tuxedo, and she's got a gown on, and we walk to the car. Needless to say, that was my last date. We went to a place called Romanov's. It was the place to go in Hollywood. And supper club, that type thing. And he was a prince from Romania. Mm-hmm. But he really, really wasn't. He was a phony prince, but he went by that Prince Romanov. And so we're in there having supper or dinner after the movie. It's about 11 o'clock at night, and Luella Parsons came by. Well, she could make or break anybody in Hollywood. She was mm-hmm. a great columnist that wrote about the stars and whatever. Right. And so she came up to Elizabeth Taylor and said, who's your date tonight? She said, this is Ralph Kiner. She said, oh, what does he do? And she said, well, he plays for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Well, it so happened that next day on Sunday, this is a Saturday night, the Pittsburgh Steelers football team was playing the Rams in the Coliseum. And so she thought I was with that team, and she said, well, I hope your team wins tomorrow. So that was kind of a disaster.
Well, they say the Dodgers always have complexes because they're not the big stars in their own backyard because of all those Hollywood stars. Who are some of the Hollywood stars that you got to meet besides Crosby and Elizabeth Taylor?
I used to play a lot of golf at Lakeside, which was the hangout of most of the stars. They had W.C. Fields, he played there. They had Forrest Tucker, they had Crosby, they had Hope, they had, I don't know, you name him. Earl Flynn, I can't even think of all the ones that were there. Mm. Bel Air and Lakeside were where all the movie people were, and they were awesome, they really were. I mean, Gene Autry was